This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Holly Jacobs' life turned upside down on New Year's Day, 2009. A friend called to alert her that someone had hacked her Facebook account and that her profile picture had been changed to a photo of her naked body. Jacobs took the photo down, but the profile picture was just a small piece of the damage. Jacobs had sent her ex-boyfriend sexually explicit images of herself while they were dating, and now those images were posted on hundreds of websites. They'd been sent to her family members, her employer, and even students at the university where she taught. Holly went to the police but was told that what had been done to her was not a criminal offense. She tried to take down the images on her own, sometimes spending 5 or 6 hours a day contacting website operators with takedown requests, but she never succeeded in erasing the images from the internet. Holly Jacobs was the first widely publicized victim of so-called revenge porn, the distribution of sexually explicit images of a person without their consent. Since the Jacobs case, 16 states have implemented laws criminalizing revenge porn. North Carolina lawmakers are considering a measure here that would make it a felony to distribute certain kinds of non-consensual pornography. Law professor and activist Marianne Franks wrote model legislation that many states have used to draft revenge porn laws. She teaches at the University of Miami Law School and is vice president of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and joins me now. Marianne Franks, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Kathy Packer. She teaches internet and media law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and is the co-director of UNC's Center for Media Law and Policy. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you very much.
Let me start with you, Marianne Franks. What are the effects of non-consensual pornography? Tell us about this and how widespread this is. We talked about Holly Jacobs, but how widespread is this phenomenon?
Unfortunately, we don't yet know just how widespread the phenomenon is because there aren't really any official statistics and no one is really keeping track of this in a systematic way. What we know is that at our initiative, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, we get contacted by 2 or 3 victims every week, sometimes a lot more, and we've helped over 2,000 victims so far. And based on media reports, we get the sense that this is a fairly common occurrence. One study has suggested that as many as 1 in 10 couples, one person in that couple, has threatened to disclose these images without consent, and that 60% of that portion has actually followed through with the threat. So we're looking at a phenomenon that seems to be very much on the rise and that has devastating effects. You've heard a little about Holly's story. What we hear from victims all the time is that they suffer deep psychological trauma. Many of them are diagnosed with depression and PTSD in light of what happens to them. Many of them are fired from their jobs or they're kicked out of school. Many of them are rejected in their families. Many of them have seen their current intimate relationships deteriorate. And in some of the very worst cases, we've seen victims commit suicide.
So when Holly went to the police, she was told that there were no criminal laws had been broken. But aren't there any civil remedies?
Well, there are actually some criminal remedies that the police did look into, mainly a harassment charge, which turned out to not to work out for various reasons. But civil remedies are always a possibility in these cases. But civil remedies require legal counsel, which can be extremely time-consuming as well as extremely expensive. And in many cases, these types of actions are going to bring more attention to the material that a person is trying to get removed. And the chances of success are extremely low. So we haven't seen that civil remedies have really done much to affect this problem.
Kathy Packer, can you talk about some of the reasons that civil litigation, some other reasons why it might not be effective?
One of the problems in these cases is trying to identify the person who posted the photographs. Some of these sites don't collect IP addresses, so they don't even have them. And some of these people use anonymizing software, so they can be hard to find. So this is a big problem. Also, when you're talking about civil remedies, you know, if you win, well, you're not going to win any money if the person doesn't have any money, so they may not have. And the photograph could be somewhere else. You may get a judge to order photos taken down, and somebody else may already have copied it onto some other website, because people who study this talk about how this kind of abuse of women online encourages a kind of piling on, kind of a mob mentality. So these photos get passed around. So you may get it taken off one website, but it can still be somewhere else.
And why not? I mean, again, Marianne Franks talked about looking into harassment. Why would that be hard to prosecute from a criminal standpoint?
Well, the reports are that I've read is that local police aren't always good at prosecuting these cases. It's not like on television where you send it to the cyber crimes unit and somebody is really clever and they can identify who posted who the poster was.
And I guess it comes back to that too, that you have to find out who did it before you can even file charges.
Right. And there also has to be a will to find them. And there are plenty of reports that police have been dismissive of women's complaints. And they just think it's some, you and your boyfriend had a fight and you ought to just settle this or just stay off the internet and ignore it. And so they haven't always been taken very seriously.
Well, Marianne Franks, along those lines, because police agencies, prosecutors might not take it seriously, how much of that has to do with the fact that you may have given that photograph to the ex-boyfriend or the ex-partner, and so there's a sense that there was something consensual about the initial transaction?
What we've seen is that seems to drive a lot of the prejudice, you could call it, against victims, that there's a lot of moral judgment around these cases when they involve some consensual sharing to begin with. There tends to be a little bit more sympathy if the victim never knew that she was being recorded or if somehow the picture was stolen or some other way misappropriated. But in cases, very common cases, where the victim consensually posed for the photograph or created the photograph or disclosed it to the intimate partner, there tends to be a sense in which she brought this on herself. And it's a kind of attitude we've seen in other types of cases, sexual assault cases, for instance, that law enforcement and the general public tends to blame the victim's actions, what she could have done differently, what she should have done differently, instead of focusing on what should be clear, which is people share things with intimate partners all the time. They expose themselves literally and figuratively to their romantic partners, and that should not be something that's considered a punishable or even in any way a responsible type of action. What's really the problem here is that someone has decided to disclose that image without consent.
And then you get into sort of property laws, intellectual property, and it turns out that unless you took the picture, you don't really own the picture. Am I right?
That's correct. As far as copyright law is concerned, unless you yourself created the photograph, you don't have the copyright. You don't have power over the copyright.
All right. So what makes a good non-consensual pornography law? Marianne Franks, you've been working on this for a while.
What would make a good non-consensual pornography law is to very clearly state the elements, which are the distribution of a sexually explicit image without that person's consent, when you knew or should have known that person hasn't consented, with some important exceptions for voluntary exposure in public or commercial settings or for the public interest.
So if there was if it was a commercial transaction, then you let it go. But if not, so you make these, and it does seem to me that making exceptions is a difficult act that takes a lot of skill, because you can also easily run afoul of free speech rights. Am I right?
That's correct. Anytime you're trying to craft a statute that does impact freedom of expression, you have to be very careful to make sure that law is very narrowly drafted and does not have, or at least limits, any unintended consequences. And so the way that we have thought about doing this and have consulted with experts and advocates on the subject is to ensure that the scope of the statute is not so broad as to sweep in every possible sexually explicit image, creating a world in which you would have to get everybody's consent before you forwarded a pornographic image from a website, but instead really those types of images that people are aware of or that reasonable people would know were in fact private and not meant to be shared.
And Kathy Packer, as we said, the North Carolina legislature is considering some legislation that would deal with this. You were concerned when you saw the first draft of that, just along the lines of these sort of First Amendment concerns that we have.
I'm concerned whenever I hear the General Assembly is considering writing a statute that impacts free expression. I'm always concerned, and I think, which I think is the correct attitude to take. Doesn't mean I oppose all regulations, but I think they need to be very careful.
And what about the legislation as it stands now, the last version of that that you've seen? How does it look to you?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised. I thought they did a nice job of trying to do exactly what Marianne said they should do, which is to, you know, to narrowly tailor this and not to overreact and try to make it a crime to post naked pictures on the internet, pictures that could be fully protected by the First Amendment. They could be artistic photographs, for example, or news photos. And there have been some around the country, some statutes written that would do that, would criminalize the posting of, you know, of art. Which our law would not do. So I don't think they've, you know, they probably, this isn't perfect, but I think you can see them working in the right direction and trying to do most of what Marianne recommended.
Have you taken a look at this, the statute as it stands now, Marianne Frank, in North Carolina, and how does it look to you?
I have taken a look. I've actually followed the evolution from the first draft that they had presented and what is now the current draft, and I actually have sort of the opposite reaction to it than Kathy does, which is I think they've moved in a very bad direction. What they have changed is they have required an intent to coerce or harass the victim, and they've also required that the person depicted has a reasonable expectation of privacy, which in itself is not a bad addition, but the definition of a reasonable expectation of privacy requires that the person be in a personal relationship and disclose the image within that relationship. Both of those additions actually narrow the scope of the statute in a way that would eliminate protections for many victims. And it does so with no benefit for First Amendment issues. In fact, the intent to harass and coerce element creates First Amendment issues because it suggests that you can commit the same type of action for profit or for entertainment, and that will be completely fine. But if you have the intent to coerce someone, it's not. And that creates issues of what's called viewpoint discrimination from a First Amendment standpoint.
The other question around intent, it seems to me, is apart from the fact that it's very hard to prove, is that you can't go after the website. And I don't know if this is in any part of what you consider model legislation. If it's hard to find the perpetrator, you can certainly find the website or the places where it appeared. Does that make a difference? And is that helpful in this kind of legislation to hold the content providers accountable? Marianne?
Well, there's a difficulty here because of a federal law known as the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which effectively provides immunity for website entities for the content posted by third parties. And that's a very broad immunity that cannot be superseded by a state criminal statute. It can be superseded by a federal criminal statute, which is something that I have been working on. But as far as being able to reach those website hosts, there will always be the chance that they can raise a so-called Section 230 defense to say this isn't my fault because it was other people who put this material on the site.
What about the Supreme Court? Have they weighed in on cases that in any way might have a bearing on the legislation that we see in North Carolina and other states? I'll stick with you for a minute, Marianne Franks.
We haven't seen the Supreme Court take on these issues directly. There haven't been many Section 230 cases that the court has looked at. There's a very interesting case that the court is due to produce an opinion on any day now called Alonis, and that has to do with a man who was making threats against his ex-wife over Facebook. So I think we're going to get a sense of how the court's going to deal with some questions of technology and social media in that case. But we do have prior cases that have to do with intentional infliction of emotional distress claims, as well as hate crime statutes in cases like RAV, in cases like Virginia versus Black. So we have some indication about how the court feels about some of these issues, but not a good sense of how they're going to deal with the intersection of technology and harassment yet.
Kathy Pecker, can you talk about the challenges of enforcing whatever laws might get passed or have been passed?
Well, I think that the enforcement problems are going to be, to really solve this problem, are really going to be difficult. And, you know, Section 230, which you referred to, is a major obstacle. And people for 10 years have been talking about needing to do away with Section 230 or change it, that it has these unintended consequences of protecting some of the worst websites, most harmful websites on the internet. And people are always appalled. And on campus recently, they've been upset about Yik Yak and, you know, hate speech on Yik Yak, things like that. So it's really hard to go after them. This also doesn't say anything about about the hacking of people's websites in order to get photos from people. You know, that's another problem. It's really difficult. But all these technology issues are very hard. It's hard to stop something once it's out on the internet. You know, as they say, it lasts forever and it goes everywhere.
Well, Mary and Franks, I wonder if that means that technology might be a better fix than legislation. Are there ways that technically you can keep photographs from being, or if they don't exist yet, are technological answers perhaps, could they be more effective than legislative?
That's certainly going to be true in some cases. If we really want to combat a phenomenon like non-consensual pornography or harassment generally, what's really called for is a kind of fight on all fronts, and that would be legislative, it would also be technological, and it would also be educational. There are obviously some deep-seated norms going on in this type of conduct where people are assuming that women's bodies are public property, in a sense, and that's not something laws can change overnight. So what we've done at the CCRI is we've also worked with major social media companies to talk about ways in which they could also address this phenomenon. So leaving legislation out of it for the moment, how could Twitter or Facebook or Reddit or Google make it more difficult for this type of information to get out there to begin with and try to stop it from going viral once it does? And we've been very pleased to see that in the last few months, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit have come out with strong anti-non-consensual pornography stances, have made it known to their users that they do not find that type of content acceptable, and that they have instituted reporting procedures for victims of this conduct. What we would like to see them do in the future is to take more positive steps towards making it difficult to get this kind of information out to the public to begin with and not leave it up to the victim to discover that she's been victimized this way. Because by the time she finds out, by the time she files a report, it could very well have proliferated onto many other sites and many other places.
I've always been surprised to find that the only owner of a photograph is the person who took it, and that is to say that the person whose image is on that photo has nothing to say about what happens. What would happen to legislation that would require the permission of everybody in that photo before we're going to post it or, you know, sort of move it on the next step? I mean, apart from, you know, the difficulty of getting it out, that's a clerical problem or administrative problem. Am I missing any kind of civil rights issues or constitutional issues by requiring anybody who's imaged to permit it being transmitted or moved around? Stay with you, Marianne Franks.
That would likely face serious First Amendment objections because we can imagine that lots of images of people might be newsworthy even though the people in them do not want that picture to get out. We can think of plenty of pictures that maybe a politician wouldn't want to get out there even though it might be in the public's interest to know about it. So I think any type of very broad legislation that attempted to require the consent of every individual who's depicted not only would be incredibly difficult to administer but would raise some serious free speech objections.
Marianne Franks is a law professor at the University of Miami Law School. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kathy Packer, an internet and media law professor and co-director of the Center for Media Law and Policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, we're going to talk with an award-winning slam poet on the state of things. Stay tuned.